this book, the Bible that I use, the New American, this particular one that I use was manufactured out on Shallotford Road. There's a company located between Lee Highway and Hickory Valley called AMG, and they make Bibles. And the guy that ran it for a long time, he died a couple years ago, was Greek. His name is Zohadides, and but he was a Greek scholar. Ginger has gotten me several of his books that he's written on different aspects of the Bible. I've got one about that thick that just covers the book of James. And he takes it pretty much part of a sentence. He'll take one verse and divide it up in different parts, and he'll devote three or four pages to it. It's interesting reading. I need to get back to that. He presents a lot of good thoughts that a Greek scholar would know in how the language is put together, plus the history. So he's an interesting person of note. The reason I say all that, what I'm going to do this morning in the start of this study is he's got some inspired notes, and I really want to read that this morning. I hate to do that. I don't want to do that in a normal exercise of the class. What I have enjoyed in the last year with David's class in here is the amount of discussion that goes on, and I really appreciate that from my past teaching experiences where that doesn't always happen. So please feel free to speak up and ask questions. Even though I've been here a year, some of you, I don't know your names yet. So this will give me an opportunity to work on that. So if I respond to you if you hold your hand up or start talking, if I don't know your name, one, I may just bluntly ask you who you are, what your name is, just so I can learn. It's not to embarrass you in any way, but I'll need to do that. I may not call out your name, and then I'll try and seek you out after class and find out. But this will give me an opportunity to learn more of your names and get familiar with everyone. I usually, like David, try and develop a class to ask questions, to get discussion started. I think that's a better learning scenario. Trust me, I'm no preacher. I don't want to get up here and try and do that. Sometimes I will. And let me just say right up front, I apologize. Okay? So, Romans chapter 1, and we'll go through this introductory part. It was written in Corinth by Paul around 57, 58 A.D. Of course, he wrote it to the church in Rome, that congregation there. And, usually we try and find some reason. We hope to find some reason of why a particular letter was written. And, I think it's interesting and probably amazing in how the church grew and developed and worked through the initial phases of combining Jews and Gentiles. And think about it. If you've been a Jew all your life and worshiped in the temple and listened to the Pharisees, and then this guy Jesus comes along and he says, there's a better way, and I'm going to die and I'm going to be raised up and live again and go to heaven, that's an amazing concept and hard, probably hard to really grasp. But there was enough of the Jews that saw that and said, that was real. That's what this life is supposed to have been about. And then for not particularly religious people, the Greeks, the Gentiles, the heathens too, you know, that had maybe some belief system in one God, two gods, a bunch of gods, to come along and go, there's something to that as well, and I want to be a part of that and accept it. So we take an established belief system in Judaism, in the law, in how that was entrenched in those people's lives, and marry them up with people that don't know anything. And so it's bound to set up a situation to where there's going to be conflict, in my mind. And I think in a lot of Paul's writings, he's trying to address those sort of things. And so I think that's what's going on here in the book of Romans. So I think this is a good book to study following what David has been teaching for the last year, because Paul pulls a whole lot of stuff out of Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, and places it in here in Romans. It refers to it. And I think there's a couple reasons. One, to remind the Jews of their heritage and what God was really trying to get forward in their minds that they had never really heard or seen. And then two, as a primer, if you will, for some of the Gentiles, because they are coming into something brand new. So it's written in my mind to both groups of people to help marry them together better, in a better sense, okay? So that's my talking for right here. And now I'm going to read to you. So again, I apologize. Coleridge, who was a late 1700s, early 1800s poet, philosopher, theologian, called Paul's letter to the Romans the most profound work in existence. By far, the book of Romans contains Paul's most comprehensive statement of the full meaning of the cross of Christ. Paul says, "For I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power of God for salvation to everyone who believes, to the Jew first and also to the Greek." That's Romans 1:16. From the very start, Paul develops a theme that all people, whether Jewish or Gentile, are sinners and therefore need God's salvation. But how can this be done? And Paul writes meticulously that the only way is through a personal relationship with Jesus Christ through faith and complete obedience to him. Salvation cannot come through frail human attempts to obey any law perfectly. And then Paul explains what a new life in Christ entails. No longer does an individual need to live under the constant domination of sin and guilt and death. The believer is liberated by the Spirit of God and has inner peace, as well as peace with God, and all hostilities have ceased. Paul goes to great lengths to expound God's original purpose in giving the law of Moses, and how the Jews were a part of God's master plan to bring all nations home through the grace provided by the cross of Jesus Christ. And Paul concludes with many practical things about how Christians should live in this world. We must serve one another. We must be good citizens. We must be tolerant and sensitive to the consciences of others. The Epistle to Romans, above everything else, is an explanation of how God justifies the sinner. The verb in Greek for justify is dikaio. In Romans, it is used 14 times and in Galatians, 8 times. There's a great theological affinity between Romans and Galatians as to how God justifies the sinner. In the rest of the New Testament, the verb is only used 14 times. And it's a legal term, meaning to declare someone as just or righteous and to recognize him as such. It refers to one who is not subject to condemnation. A just person in the New Testament is one who meets God's standards for his life. In the New Testament, the word for to justify never means what the word meant in classical Greek, that is, to make anyone righteous by doing away with the violation of law through his own condemnation. The New Testament never speaks of anybody justifying himself because he has paid the penalty for his sin. The important matter is who declares or considers a person just. The Pharisees considered themselves just and righteous. They had their own standard of righteousness. The young lawyer who came to Jesus in Luke chapter 10, verse 29, wanted to justify himself. And one can be just in his own eyes by setting his own standard. Another can justify himself when he meets his legal obligations towards specific laws. This is being justified by the law. The law cannot bring this man before the court and charge him with specific violations of the law. But for one to justify himself before God, he must first of all acknowledge what are God's rights upon him. In order to do this, man must know God. And that's where Paul is going to start in Romans chapter 1. Okay, and that's where it really begins for all of us. First off, we have to know God and who he is, that he is just, and he has a plan for each one of us. It's not our plan on what we can do for God, okay? It's what God's plan is for us. And that's the first and foremost important concept, I think, of Christianity. All right. The knowledge of God is the same as the appropriation of the righteousness of God. It is not mere proclamation by God that a person is free from the charge that others or the law can bring against him, but that God himself considers him as having legally and morally fulfilled all that he demands to declare him justified. God could not find such a just person on earth, but when it came to his son Jesus Christ, there was no unrighteousness in him. In Romans 18:1-19, we find how God considers fallen man. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. In other words, they do not do what is right because they have not recognized God himself, which is expressed in the word asabia or ungodliness. Let me stop there. I'm having a hard time reading because of the recent eye surgery that I had. I still got a bubble in this eye, and about halfway through up the eyeball, I can still see the bubble, and it bounces around. So I'm dealing with that a little bit. But anyway, back to the reading. The person who does not recognize God for what he is, as just, cannot recognize God's rights upon his life. This, however, leaves man without excuse because God has given him the ability innately to know, at least in part, God's that which is known about God. God's right, but man willfully disregards even that partial knowledge. And I think the great example of this, and Paul is going to get to this, is Abraham. Okay? He, living in the Ur of Chaldees, which was a heathen nation of people that served other gods or just lived wantonly without respect to anyone. But this man Abraham, he questioned that. And I think that's why God picked him, is in that he looked and saw the evidence of nature, which the writer here is talking about, the innate things. And Paul will talk about that as well. He saw those things in recognized that there had to be something greater. If you saw the eclipse a couple weeks ago, and it's amazing how all these bodies in space move around and they don't hit one another. You know, not with, certainly that's something that man cannot put together and cause to happen. If you look at how life begins with man and woman coming together and what proceeds out of that, to you get to our age, living long, full lives. It's an amazing thing that certainly man at that point in time could not, you know, have any impact on other than the continuation of life. Although now we think we're smart enough to affect some of those things, but we're just fooling ourselves. You know, the changes in the season and how things come about and go and come back, you know, all these things speak to a higher authority, you know, that all this has been designed on purpose for reasons. And so God has put that there for us to see and to question, to cause us to reach out to Him. And so that's a point Paul's going to make here, and we'll talk about that again. Observe verse 19 in chapter 1, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. Because, therefore, man has not properly responded to God's rights toward him generally, manifested to mankind, he is filled with unrighteousness, expressing itself in fornication, wickedness, covetousness, maliciousness, envy, murder, debate, deceit, malignity, whispering, and etc. The verb dikaio, to justify, sometimes must be understood as meaning to appear as righteous, as in Romans 2:13, for not the hearers of the law are just before God, but the doers of the law shall be justified. We cannot take this latter statement to mean truly justified unto salvation, but as appearing justified. The doers of the law are justified by the law, but not by God. Therefore, the word justify here has a limited application. Otherwise, this statement would stand in contradiction to Romans 3:20. There by the deeds of the law there shall no flesh be justified in his sight. For by law is the knowledge of sin. And then again in Romans 4:2 we read, if Abraham was justified by works, he has something to boast about, but not before God. But how can man be justified before God? The answer is given of Christ in the Spirit, by his grace, not by the works of the law, and not with the law, not by works, but by faith which is followed by works as demonstration of its genuineness. In Romans 4:5, we find that it is God who justifies the ungodly through Jesus Christ. Above everything else, this must be understood. God does not only declare us justified, but makes us just, as discussed in Romans 5:19. The verb makes us is kastemi, meaning to constitute. He clears us of the guilt of sin and gives us power against sin. And so that's this writer's introduction to the book of Romans and what it's going to address. So any questions or comments so far? All right, let's get on to the text. Romans chapter 1, verses 1 through 4. Paul, a bondservant of Christ Jesus, called as an apostle, set apart for the gospel of God, which he promised beforehand through his prophets in the Holy Scriptures, concerning his Son, who was born of a descendant of David, according to the flesh, who was declared the Son of God with power by the resurrection from the dead, according to the Spirit of holiness, Jesus Christ our Lord. So here's Paul's introduction, but it has a whole lot of stuff in it. What position in life did Paul hold before he was made an apostle, before Jesus came to him? A lawyer, okay, a Pharisee, and not just a run-of-the-mill Pharisee, not a run-of-the-mill lawyer. He called himself a Pharisee of Pharisees, so he looked at himself as upper tier. What other position did Paul hold as well, besides being a Jew and a Pharisee? Okay, all right. Right. Yes, sir. Something more basic. Yes, sir. Exactly. That's what I was going for. Thank you. So he was a Roman citizen. So does it seem plausible that Paul, as a Roman citizen, maybe, and maybe even a Pharisee, was a slave owner, which was common in that time, wasn't it? Okay. I find it amazing that here he calls himself in verse 1 a bond servant. All right. So he's gone from maybe owning a slave, and I'm just speculating on that. There's no biblical explanation of that. But he may have been a slave owner, and he's gone from that to now subjecting himself as a slave as well. And certainly for a good reason. Okay. Turn to Exodus chapter 21. And I'm sure Paul may have thought about this. But in verse 5 and 6, but if the slave plainly says, I love my master, and this is talking about the freeing of the slaves after a period of time, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out as a free man, then his master shall bring him to God, and then he shall bring him to the door or doorpost. His master shall pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him permanently. So a slave, under the Jewish system, had the ability, one, to be freed, but if his master had been kind to him and he wanted to stay with him, he had that option in life to do so. And so I think in this first verse, Paul got to that same point in life. As Joel was talking, he was well known as a persecutor of the church. And so imagine this Pharisee of Pharisees going down this road, and he gets stopped by Jesus. He's blinded, okay? Blinded for, 3 days? And during that time frame, he's taken to Christians, and they more rightly explain the truth to him. And so he becomes convinced as a lawyer, they go through the methodology of taking fact and presenting them such that it convicts a person, and he's convicted himself in that he knows, even though he was, doing what he thought was best for God, what God wanted him to do, he recognized at that point in time that he was wrong. And so he repents for those things and turns his life around and is baptized and now becomes the servant of God. Okay? Was Paul really an apostle? What do we usually say that the requirements are to be an apostle? Sir? Excuse me? Okay. I mean, because some people questioned it during that time frame, and he had to justify it for himself. But usually he was, you know, had been around Jesus, you know, the ones that were first named apostles. But they were all handpicked by him. And so on the road to Damascus, Paul was picked by Jesus to fill this same role. So he was set apart for the gospel of God. And to me, that's, you know, it's more than just preaching. I ran into Pat and Jack at lunch Friday at Panera, and you've probably seen, I think probably down at 7th and Market, periodically there'll be street preachers down there that will just harangue you with, you know, you need to repent and all the stuff that they go through. And you know, you have to admire people that do that for having the guts to get out in public and try and reach out to someone. Effective, maybe not so much, but there will be men and women, I guess, at times that do that sort of thing. So the gospel is more than just preaching a bunch of words. It's really a life. And that's what Paul, I think, is trying to set apart here. And he was effective about it. Turn to Mark chapter 6. In verse 34. And there's a companion verse in Matthew 9, chapter 36. That says pretty much the same thing. And Jesus is looking out over the people, and this is the incident where they fed the 5,000 people. And when he went ashore, he saw a great multitude, and he felt compassion for them because they were like sheep without a shepherd. And he began to teach them many things. The purpose of the Pharisees was to do what for the children of Israel? To teach them? To be leaders? Okay. And he categorizes the scene here as, you know, they're people without a shepherd. And as sheep, we need people to guide us, to lead us. That's in the church what the position of the elder is for. Not to be dictators or, you know, rulers, but to lead. Okay? And I'm thankful for these men because I think they do that very well. But Jesus recognized that what was happening in his time, these people weren't being led, and they were like sheep without a shepherd, just wandering around. So Paul here says he was called as apostle, set apart for the gospel, to bring about the preaching of the gospel, certainly the teaching of it, but also to start the standard, I think, of leadership, of what a Christian life is supposed to be, and developing the congregations, the leaders, the men there. Of course, certainly he had a few helpers in this work with Timothy and others. But that was his main purpose. In verse 2, Paul describes Christ as the heart of the gospel. He sets Christ before us in three different ways. First, he's revealed and has been promised beforehand. Okay. Two, he is set before us as the reigning one, the descendant of David, which is defined in Matthew and Luke with the lineage of Jesus and how he came to be. The New Testament starts and ends with reference to David concerning Christ in Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, and Revelations 22:16. Paul declares this in two different ways. Positionally, he is from the seed of David, and two, he is personally Christ the Lord. And then in the third way that Paul describes Christ in verse 4 is he is the resurrected one, the Son of God. When in verse 4 it talks about him having a spirit of holiness, okay, what does this imply? What do you think this means? Okay. Remember in the introduction we talked about God looked for someone that was just on the earth, and there was no person there. And so he had to create that person, right? And he did that through Mary in having his son come to earth and take up this life. And so he had to have a just sacrifice for each one of us. And what that implies is a number of things. He never looked upon any woman with lust. Okay. He never was unkind. He was never untrue. He was never spoke a frivolous word. He never had an impure thought. He never was accused by his own conscience. He never had to apologize for anything. He never was upset, shallow, afraid, struck back at anyone. Okay. So the spirit of holiness takes into account all these things. Things that we may strive for, but we often have hard times with them. At least I do, anyway. And then the discussion of the resurrection from the dead declares he was victorious over sin. Go back to Paul's encounter with Christ on the road to Damascus. He was a Pharisee of Pharisees on a mission. He had been part of crucifying Christ. He was bigger than life until he met Christ, who overcame death. And he was chosen to take this gospel and make it personal for each one of us. So in Paul's greeting or beginning of Romans, all that is bound up in those verses. Can I get someone to read verses 5 through 16? Please.
Not with you.
verse 16. All right, thank you. All right, thank you, Joel. I've been coached by my darling wife that I need to involve more people, and so I'll ask people to read selections instead of me reading and talking all the time. So. She's right. I just have a hard time doing that sometimes. I forget. So, and she's good at reminding me. So in these verses, Paul discusses his mission as a servant of the gospel. In verse 5, what does Paul says comes first? What's one of the most important things? What does he list first there? Okay. Grace is what I've got, okay? Obedience will come about when we understand the grace of God, okay? What's rolled up into that understanding? Okay, but if we understand that we're sinners, you know, don't we need to understand that there's grace awaiting for us to where we know we have an avenue to come back? You know, if I mess up at work and I know the boss is angry with me and I get the phone call, come into my office, you know, and probably all of us have had that little discussion before, you know, it can go one of two ways. He can either try and be helpful and go, hey, we messed up. We need to figure out what we're going to do, how we're going to recover. You know, can you go do that? You know what you did wrong, and let's try not to do that again, right? Or it can go the other way as to he just pounds me, okay? And so as sinners, we need to understand, I think, first, that there is this avenue of grace that's available to us before the rest of it can take place. So the other classes are letting out. We'll stop right here. We will start back next week. I apologize for my stumbling, but I do that a lot, and try and get better. Thank you.